My name is Keith Beavers, and being a country music fan in 2024 is a vibe. And I want to thank Gen Z because they're going back to like the 70s Dwight Yoakam era, and it's amazing. What's going on, wine lovers from the Vine Pair Podcasting Network? This is the Wine 101 Podcast. My name is Keith Beavers, and I am the Tastings Director of Vine Pair. Vine Pair. Here we are with a little supplemental, because I feel like Gamay and Beaujolais were part of the Burgundian story and just kind of got, I don't know, disappeared. We're going to reappear it. Does that make any sense? I feel like we have to talk about Beaujolais just because it's sort of considered part of the Burgundy region, but not. The Oxford Wine Companion says that that Beaujolais is often administratively included with Burgundy, but obviously they couldn't be more different from each other. Even in Beaujolais itself, there are differences, sort of like the Rhone, which we're going to be talking about next, by the way, a little preview there, spoiler alert. But if you know about Beaujolais, if you've known about it recently, it's because it's becoming more popular. But if you know about Beaujolais, even before this sort of like resurgence of popularity, you remember things like Beaujolais Nouveau. You understand a Beaujolais, like what is this light fruity thing? And then you get into it and you're like, oh, wow, there's all these different crews. By the way, there is a Beaujolais episode where I break down the whole region. Go ahead and do, search Wine 101 Beaujolais on Spotify or whatever. It'll pop up. But Beaujolais has its own story of how it became famous. And it's pretty cool. I had to do a lot of work on this one because places like Burgundy and Champagne and Bordeaux, I mean, their histories are so well recorded. Oddly enough, the wine region just south of one of the most famous wine regions in the world, Burgundy, it's not as easy to figure out, but there's some, when you find it and you put it all together, it's pretty cool. So let's get into it. You see, Beaujolais had its own duchy. There were dukes of Beaujolais because in the 10th century, a new city was formed called Beaujou. And in that place, Beaujou, there were dukes, the Dukes of Beaujou. They are the ones that gave name to the Beaujolais region. And of course, they also had monasteries and monks and stuff like that. And the dukes interacted with the monks and the wine. And actually, the first Duke of Beaujou, his name was Bérard. He was a wine merchant. So wine has been part of the Beaujolais region for a long time as well. But where the Burgundians were focused mostly on the city of Dijon, the people of Beaujou were concentrated mostly on the city of Lyon. And in the 14th century, when Philip the Bold put out his decree, in that episode of the Burgundian series, we're kind of in it still, but I talked about how Philip was, he was a duke and he was very self-involved and had his own agenda, but still he was trying to make wine of quality in the area. But the thing was, what was happening around this time, this is right before the Renaissance began, the Black Plague was around and people were dying left and right. So in Burgundy, Gamay was being planted very vociferously because people knew it was a highly productive variety, not the fickle Pinot Noir, and they knew they could make money on it. So that's why Philip was getting all upset. He's like, yo, whoa, what's going on here? And it was for two reasons. Number one, he just wanted Burgundy to be known for Pinot Noir, but then, or Noirien at the time, or Morillon. But he also I don't need all this stuff. I get that everyone needs to make money, but I need this to be a good wine producing place. So that's kind of how that was going. But down near Beaujou, Gamay was doing just fine. Again, we talked about this before, but the vine does much better in the granitic soils of this region than the ones just north in the limestone soils of Beaune and Côte de Nuit. So this place was realizing Gamay, and Burgundy was realizing their Pinot Noir situation in Chardonnay eventually. Also in the 14th century, Lyon comes under French rule again. This is, again, we talked about this last episode, but this is when the royalty starts going, okay, we need this back. No more dukes. This is us. This is ours. And we're going to start talking to the priests next. Also in this century, 14th into the 15th century, two things happened in Lyon that really helped the wines of Beaujolais. Number one, Lyon is giving very Renaissance energy by becoming a center of publishing and literature. And that brings culture and money into Lyon. Also, in the 14th century, going into the 15th century, the silk trade comes to Lyon and becomes a major production headquarters of the silk trade. This will eventually ramp up because of this, Italian merchants come to Lyon and start doing fairs. These big sort of, it's a fair, like a county fair or whatever, and they sell their wares, and it becomes a big industry among the silk trade in Lyon. Lyon becomes an economic banking center internationally, and then even though international banking eventually leaves Lyon and goes to Genoa and then Flanders, Lyon continues to be the banking center of France. Beaujeu, or the wines that are now in Beaujolais, are loving this because they are just downriver from Lyon, like pretty close, and their wines can get to Lyon pretty quickly. So there is a beginning of their wines being sold in Lyon. And by the 17th century, there's a lot of expansion of vine plantings in Beaujolais. So we're starting to see it become more popular. And it was in the 18th and 19th century where Beaujolais is realized, in that there was an explosion of workers in Lyon. Mostly they were called cunat, or silk workers. It was so intense, there's actually silk worker uprising stories there. There was enough of them to get mad about not getting paid enough and stuff like that. So it was a big, crazy, active time. The population was expanding, and the wine everyone was drinking was wine from Beaujeu, a wine from what is now Beaujolais. And it was ubiquitous. In Lyon, their restaurants are called Bouchon, and they were in almost every Bouchon. Because the wines were light and red and refreshing, there were actually some people selling Beaujeu or Beaujeu wines as Burgundy to the wealthier people, but it was the silk workers, the workers of Lyon, that were just consuming a ton of this stuff. The demand got so high that they started sending barrels of wine from Beaujeu to Lyon while they were still fermenting. This was, I think, the sort of beginnings of what would be Beaujolais Nouveau. And in the 19th century, when that railway was built from Dijon to Paris, forget about it. Beaujolais made its way to the bistros of Paris, whether it's dry, light, and chilled, or whether it's still fermenting, juicy Nouveau style, they went nuts for it, and it became ubiquitous in Paris, eventually making its way to London. And that, wine lovers, is how Beaujolais became famous in its own right. It deserves its own story. Here it is. It's separate than everybody else, as usual, and it's very cool. But I want to mention one more thing about Beaujolais. And it's their ability to accept the phylloxera thing before Burgundy, which is just very interesting. In the 19th century, there was a guy by the name of Victor Pouillat. He was in Chirobles, which is a commune in Beaujolais. He was inspired by a book by a guy named Alexandre Pierre Odart, who ended up happening. This guy is actually the guy who helped make Piedmont and Barolo a thing. It's another story. But he was so inspired that he began collecting vines from all over the world just to study them. But he loved the vines and the wines in his home, and he co-founded a trade journal literally just called The Vineyard, which was published between 1874 and 1880. During this time, when phylloxera was being realized, he actually founded the Lyon Viticultural Society, and he devoted his energy to combating phylloxera and phylloxera alone. He was the guy who was like, look, the American solution is a solution. We need to start grafting our vines onto American rootstock so this ends. People were resistant, just like in Burgundy, but when the French embargo of American vines was lifted in 1879, Burgundy was still like, nah, not yet. But this guy was really cool. He would go to church on Sunday and offer, after church was over, to help people learn how to graft vines and trying to explain to them, I think calmly, because this guy sounded like a really chill, patient guy, why this would benefit them. And his contribution to the acceptance of the American rootstock or the American solution is one of the big reasons why Beaujolais thrives today. And they've actually honored him. They have something called the Victor Pouillet Prize for the best vintages in each cru at an annual fair, or I think an event called Fête de Cruz. So I thought that was very cool. Now, so, you know, Beaujolais has its own famous person. There's actually a statue of him in the town. It's pretty awesome. So that's Beaujolais. I know this is a very short episode, but I figured have a little supplemental here because it deserves its own story. That's its story. Next week, guys, wow, we're going deep into the Rhone. This is going to be nuts. This is going to be nuts. See you next week. Vine Pair Keith is my Insta. Rate and review this podcast wherever you get your podcasts from. It really helps get the word out there. And now for some totally awesome credits. Wine 101 was produced, recorded, and edited by yours truly, Keith Beavers, at the Vine Pair headquarters in New York City. I want to give a big old shout out to co-founders Adam Teeter and Josh Mallon for creating Vine Pair. And I mean, big shout out to Danielle Grinberg, the art director of Vine Pair, for creating the most awesome logo for this podcast. Also, Darby Seaside for the theme song. Listen to this. And I want to thank the entire Vine Pair staff for helping me learn something new every day. See you next week.